evening, and welcome to Dunnell Edwards Viewpoints, and I'm your host, Dunnell Edwards. In addition to our listeners in the United States, we welcome our international audience in the United Kingdom, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, the Netherlands, Argentina, Thailand, and Norway. Welcome everyone to CWR Nation. The theme for tonight's program is The Many Perils of Our Broken Foster Care System, Incarceration, Homelessness, Poverty, and Addiction. Most people are familiar with the horror stories associated with our foster care system. Our guest for this program, Ms. Shenandoah Shuffalo, is a product of that foster care system that managed to overcome the odds and the failures of the system. She shares her personal story in her book, Garbage Bag Suitcase, where she describes her childhood with drug and alcohol addicted parents, numerous moves in the middle of the night with just minutes to pack, multiple changes in schools, hunger, cruelty, and loneliness. Shenandoah asked to be put into foster care after being abandoned at her grandmother's retirement community by her drug-addicted mother at the age of 13. She dreamed about a stable home with foster parents who loved and cared for her. Unfortunately, her new family was more interested in the income they received by housing a foster child than actually caring for her. However, she was not defeated by her turbulent journey through foster care, but instead she overcame the odds and became part of the 3% of all foster care children who get into college and the 1% who graduate. She is a graduate of Michigan State University, holding a Bachelor of Arts with a major in Interdisciplinary Studies in Social Science, a Core Essentials graduate from Coach University, a certified Law of Attraction Advanced Practitioner, and a member of the Foster Leaders Movement. She is a sought-after speaker on topics surrounding youth in foster care. She is also a successful mother, businesswoman, and author. Please join me in welcoming our special guest for tonight on Dunnell Edwards Viewpoints, Ms. Shenandoah Shuffalo.
Welcome.
Now, Thanks for having me, Dunnell.
You're very welcome. Shenandoah, please share with our audience a brief overview of your early childhood, which we kind of touched on a little bit, and then your journey through the foster care system.
Yeah, so as you said in your introduction, which thank you, it was a very great introduction, you know, but the first 13 years of my life were very turbulent. I moved over 50 times before graduating from high school, attending over 35 schools in my career all across the United States. So I'm originally from Southern California, and so I lived in San Diego and Los Angeles, and we moved to Las Vegas and spent time in Salt Lake City and Denver and Boulder, Colorado, and eventually made our way basically from west to east of the United States, oftentimes moving, as you said, in the middle of the night, oftentimes enrolling for school and staying maybe only for a week or so before we would move and enroll in a new school again. And that was pretty much my childhood. And I thought that that was a pretty normal childhood, not knowing any differently. And when I was 13, I got left at my grandmother's house, and my grandmother was going to be evicted from her retirement community. And so I made the decision to call the authorities on myself, thinking that foster care would be the best scenario for me. At the time, the only other orphan I knew was little orphan Annie and her curly red hair. And I thought, well, it had worked out so well for her that perhaps it would work out that way for me. And that wasn't the case. There was just more upheaval in my life, lots of moving around from placement to placement. And then eventually at the age of 18, when I aged out, when you turned 18, the midnight of your birthday, you're pretty much done with care, and then you're out on your own. So it was going from sort of one terrible situation to the next. What's perhaps maybe a little bit unique about my situation is that when I turned 18, I decided that I would never tell anybody about my time in care. And that was a secret I managed to keep for about 22 years. In fact, keeping that secret from my husband and my daughter as well, until I sort of came face to face with a bunch of people in the job I was working at in criminal defense work, who started confiding in me that they had spent time in the foster care system. And I started to realize that there were some connections between foster care and incarceration and foster care and homelessness that I quite hadn't seen before as a kid, and decided it was time to share my story in detail so we could explore some solutions on how we could make the system better, because I had noted in the 30 years since I had been in the system, really not much had changed.
Okay. Now, would you say for your early years, I guess up until the time that you were about 18, would you say that your story, your experience is probably kind of typical for most people in the system?
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely people who will tell you that they had it better. There's definitely people who had it worse. But I think we're all typical in that we feel that we sort of don't fit in anywhere. We don't have a permanent family. We don't have somewhere to go, you know, for Thanksgiving and the holidays. And so there's a lot of things for sure that I have in common with other people who aged out of the system. And we often talk about, hey, do you do this? You know, and one of those things, just as an example, is a lot of us claim to be bad gift receivers. Most foster kids are good gift givers. We love to pick out gifts for other people, but we can feel really uncomfortable, and it's very difficult for us to receive gifts from other people. And so there's these sort of quirky things that begin to happen in your personality that science is helping us to understand are actually linked to the things that have happened to us in childhood.
You know, it's really interesting to me what you said previously before that particular comment about wanting to keep your experience in the foster care system secret, and doing that mm-hmm. for as long as you did and keeping it from your family. First of all, why did you feel you wanted to do that? And secondly, how were you able to do that for so long?
Well, it's an interesting thing. The how were you able to do it, people are usually surprised by. But the truth is it's not a question we usually ask people. Hey, did you spend time in foster care? It's not something we usually ask. And so, frankly, a lot of just nobody asked, so I didn't have to tell, was the way that I was
okay.
able to keep it secret for so long. The reason that I kept it a secret was I had never experienced anything positive by telling somebody I'd been in foster care. And still to this day, in certain circles, if I talk about my experience in foster care, one of the questions that I will get is, well, what did you do wrong? You know, there's sort of this judgment and misconception that goes that kids in foster care have done something wrong. They've run away. They were stealing things. They got in trouble. They're somehow juvenile delinquents, and that's what has forced them into the foster care system, which is absolutely absurd, but a lot of people feel that way. And so I never received positive reinforcement for saying, hey, I was a kid in care. For the people who knew I was a kid in care, I got treated very differently, and it was known. And so for me, I wanted to keep it a secret so I didn't have to have that judgment anymore.
Okay, very good. Now, how did your experience in the foster care system encourage you to write your book, Garbage Bag Suitcase? We know you want to make changes in the foster care system, but how was that a motivation for writing the book?
Well, I knew that in order to get people to talk about solutions to the system, I had to share my story. You know, people need a story that they can relate to, that they can understand, and that they can sort of experience with you to understand why your viewpoint on change has value. And so I knew I would have to sort of dig deep in myself and share those stories, frankly, that I was really trying to keep hidden, to help people understand why, you know, 25, 30 years later, the same things are happening in the system. And I was just speaking to an advocate the other day who said, you know, I didn't tell anyone. I never really talked about it. I wasn't trying to hide it, but it just wasn't something that came up a lot. And then decided that he was going to adopt from the foster care system, and his kids showed up on his porch with all their stuff in a garbage bag, and he just said, you know, it's been 30 years and we're doing the same thing and nothing is getting better. And I think when you have that realization that maybe your experience can help affect change in a positive way, you really feel like you have no choice but to share that so you can potentially make it better for the kids that come after you.
Okay. Now, we would love to hear your viewpoint about the broken foster care system. If you have an experience or you know someone who's been in the system, just call us right now at 563-999-3660. That number again is 563-999-3660. Please hold the line when you call. We will get to your call as soon as possible. Right now, we're going to take a short break, and we'll return after this short network break. We will discuss what some of the problems are that result from the broken foster care system.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.
I'm jumping in with my clothes on.
Most party fouls are pretty dumb, but if you decide to drink and drive underage, you could lose your license and your freedom. Learn more at ultimatepartyfoul.org, brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Today we decided to walk to school. The light counted. 13.
We took a left on Carroll Street. Danny's smart, but he gets distracted. I realized he forgot his homework. I hope he doesn't have another bad day at school.
When you can see learning and attention issues from their side, you can be on their side. That's why there's Understood.org, a free resource for the parents of the 1 in 5 kids with learning and attention issues. Go from misunderstanding to Understood.org. Brought to you by Understood and the Ad Council.
People been saying to your friend, get a different face, and posting on their feed, they're super ugly. The things they say to them online are cruel and they're not true. So tell your friend, I'll stand up for you.
Know someone being bullied online? You can be a witness and make a difference by letting the world know it isn't cool and by letting your friend know you care. Learn more at eyewitnessbullying.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
This is the CWR Network. Hashtag 1 million strong.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, this is Donnell Edwards Viewpoints, and our very special guest is author and advocate Ms. Shenandoah Shuffalo. And our topic for discussion this evening is the many perils in our broken foster care system that result in incarceration, homelessness, poverty, and addiction. Before we resume our discussion, we would like to recognize again our CWR Network Listener of the Month, Mr. Perry Hunt from Tennessee. Perry is the recipient of a $50 Visa money card, and you could be our Listener of the Month for December. Just keep listening and visit our website at www.cwrtalknetwork.com and go to the bottom of our homepage to the CWR Nation Talks comment form and tell us why you like the CWR Network, what your favorite program is, who your favorite host is, or whatever you want to tell us or share with CWR Nation. You could be selected our next CWR Listener of the Month. Congratulations again to our CWR Listener of the Month of November, Mr. Perry Hunt. Now, getting back to our discussion, Shenandoah, you mentioned a number of things that result from the broken foster care system. To emphasize the magnitude of the problem, According to Child Welfare Information Gateway, in 2015, there were over 400,000 children in the foster care system each day in the United States. Statistics also show that nearly 61% of children in foster care age out of the system without having a place to live. Nearly 50% end up incarcerated within 2 years of aging out. And almost 80% of people on death row are former foster alumni. These statistics reveal just some of the problems that result from a broken foster care system. Please tell us what some of the other social issues and other problems are.
Well, those are great statistics. And what your listeners should know is that when we're talking about child welfare in the United States, we're always dealing a little bit with outdated information and statistics. It's sort of the way it goes. It's slow getting the information. And what we know right now is that with the opioid crisis that's happening in the U.S., that number of 400,000 is actually creeping closer to 500,000 this year. And I would bet by 2018, it will go over 500,000 children in care each day in the United States. And you're right that roughly 50% of those who age out of foster care will end up incarcerated with 2 years of aging out with a felony conviction. And what we know is that if we look at the prison statistics, we imprison about 1.6 million people in the U.S., approximately 1.2 million are former foster youth. So you're looking at somewhere between 70 and 80% of the prison population in the U.S. are former foster youth. And that statistic was one of the reasons that I started looking at the data and information, because it just seemed that one system was feeding this other system, and I became gravely concerned. And so in doing that, in studying in the research, I started to understand the science behind early childhood trauma, and realizing that those things we experience before the age of 18 can really change the way in which we perceive the world around us. And that a lot of those things, if not healed properly, or if we don't allow people to heal themselves or build resilience, leads them down a path of addiction, leads them down a path of early teen pregnancy, leads them down a path of not being employed. I think the median income of someone who ages out of the foster care system is around $8,000 per year. That's not $8,000 below the median income. That is $8,000 in total. Most will not have a high school diploma. So you can see how these things start to compact, right? You don't have a high school diploma, and then you sort of end up on the streets homeless, and maybe you begin selling drugs, and that leads to a conviction, and it's sort of one thing after the other. And when we really understand adverse childhood experiences, we can start to make these connections between those things that happen to us and the choices we make, and start to realize that we can sort of retrain our brain, if you will. You know, our brain's plastic and elastic, and it can change and mold regardless of how old we are. We can always learn new things. So it's all of that. And then just recently, we've started to look at the amount of children that are just missing from the foster care system. So this year, 2017, we know approximately 4,600 kids have gone missing, that nobody can tell us where they are from the child welfare system. So there's a lot of factors that are playing into the system that are causing us to have the results that we're seeing every day.
Okay, now you mentioned trauma and adverse childhood experiences, or as the acronym is used for that, ACEs. Other ACEs events include physical abuse, neglect, substance misuse within the household, and other factors. Now you stated that in the world of social work, there has been a movement toward trauma-informed care for ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences type life events, which allows professionals to treat trauma in a more effective and personal way. What does this shift mean for the foster care system?
Well, the shift is critical. So ACEs was developed in the late 90s by Dr. Vincent Folletti out of an obesity clinic in San Diego, California, actually, trying to understand why some of his patients could lose weight and why some other patients couldn't. And after a long series of events, he is told by a patient that she had been sexually abused as a child, and some bells start going off in his head, and he starts wondering if that has something to do with why she cannot lose weight. And they go through a whole study and learn that, in fact, people who have experienced these ACEs have a harder time keeping off the weight. But they also, in looking at these patients' medical records, realize that they had higher rates of heart disease, cancer, broken bones, missed day of work, all sorts of other health implications that went along with that. And they realized that was because, you know, when you release that cortisol, that rush of adrenaline, and I often explain it on if you were walking and you happened upon a bear and you are in that fight, flight, freeze mode, right? Each of us sort of would respond differently, but most of us would either run away or fight the bear or try to do something to appease the bear to get away. That's a great defense mechanism. It's kept humans alive for thousands of years, but it's only supposed to last for about 7 seconds. And what we found with kids living in dysfunctional and trauma-filled home lives is that they were releasing that cortisol, that release of adrenaline, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and that it was actually changing them on a cellular level. And that's why they were seeing these increased health issues. And so for the foster care system to start understanding how that early childhood trauma is affecting kids, we can start asking new questions. So instead of saying, gosh, what's wrong with that kid? Why won't he just sit down in a classroom and do his work? We can start asking, you know, what's happened to that kid? Because if you can back up that story and you can see what's going on in his home life, you can see that his behavior is really just trying to deflect from what's going on at home and some of the issues there. And his behavior is really him acting out of what I call is his trauma brain, trying to protect himself from his environment or the bear, if you will. So it's important that social workers, it's important that community members, it's important that teachers, you know, really anyone in a community understands ACEs and starts to understand that not everyone, and especially children, can control the behavior that we see, which is sometimes what we're trying to correct. And we really have to get to the root of the issue, which is what is the trauma to start with.
Okay, very good. Now, in addition to the movement toward trauma-informed care, what provisions are made within the current foster care system for children, especially very young children with developmental issues, and all foster children with health issues? Or is this part of the system that needs to be fixed?
Yeah, I think this is a part that we need to focus on. And right now, it's sort of all over the map. Each state operates very differently, and even within a state, you can find pockets or agencies doing things quite differently than other agencies. And that's probably part of the overall problem with the system in general, is that very rarely are two agencies on the same page doing the same thing. We really need to start understanding that all of these children are very different. They're each unique individual human beings. And right now, there's really not a lot of options for kids in care. There are the typical foster homes, which most of your listeners are familiar with. And then there's group homes or locked facilities for kids. Those are really the two options in most places in the country right now. And I think that's a problem because those aren't always good fits for every kid who comes through the system. I know it wasn't neither of those were a good fit for me when I came through the system. So we have to start looking at things like boarding schools and fostering the whole family in sort of some outside-the-box ways in which we can start to heal families and heal kids so that this doesn't become a revolving door. You know, for a kid who ages out of foster care, they have over a 95% chance that their own children will end up in the foster care system. So that repetitive rate is something that we really need to address.
Okay, that was another one of the questions I was intending to ask you. You are a mother now yourself. Do you feel that your experience in the foster care system has prepared you to be a better mother, or in what way has it affected you, if any, as a parent?
Oh, it's affected me tremendously, Donnell. In fact, I thought I would never have children, and that was sort of my plan, was to never have children. I was told I would never have children. And then one very cold Michigan winter's day, a doctor told me I was 6 months pregnant, and that all changed for me. And I remember being panicked because I thought, you know, what kind of mother could I be given the type of example that I had? And, you know, my husband, who was very great, was very supportive and just said, we're going to just take this one day at a time. And that's sort of what we did. I've made it to 15 and a half, so I think I'm doing okay. But, you know, it hasn't come without challenges, without limitations. I sometimes have to, you know, clarify with myself what's going on. I have to, you know, when it was time to determine what's the appropriate age for your child to watch an R-rated movie. You know, I was watching R-rated movies at 4, 5, and 6, probably not what most of us would agree is an appropriate age. And so I have to check in with other people on some of those basic things because I just didn't have that knowledge, right? I wasn't raised in that type of environment. So I do rely on outside resources to help myself and to make better decisions. And I think with time it became easier, but it was very difficult in the beginning.
Well, you are to be commended for all of the, that you have overcome and for being what appears a fantastic parent. And hopefully you will be an inspiration to anyone who is listening tonight who may have gone through the system and felt like you, that they didn't have what it took to be a successful parent. And those that come in contact with you, I'm sure you speak a lot, may be in empowered and inspired by your example as well. This is Donnell Edwards Viewpoints, and tonight our topic is the perils of our broken foster care system. And our guest is Ms. Shenandoah Shefalo, who is an author and also a foster care advocate. And what's your viewpoint about the broken foster care system? We would like to know. Call us right now at 563-999-3660 with your questions for our guest or with your comments. That number again is 563-999-3660. Please hold the line and we will get to your call as soon as possible. We're going to take another break right here, and after these announcements, we'll discuss with our guest what she feels the major problem is with the foster care system that needs to change.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.
Dave, what are you doing?
Just sending a gift to Dave 2037.
Who?
Me in the future. I save a little money from every paycheck as a gift to Dave 2037. So he can spend it on things like anti-gravity boots or a hologram Doberman, something cool like that. I think Dave 2037 deserves it. He worked hard. What are you getting Steve 2037?
I guess I was thinking Steve 2037 would just fend for himself.
Well, all right, but don't expect to be borrowing my anti-gravity boots.
You want to have money in your future? You got to start saving now. Putting some money from every paycheck into a savings account or contributing to your 401k can make a big difference later. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy ways to save, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org. Hey, let's just hope Steve 2037 doesn't get his hands on a cool time machine, because he is going to come back here and knock some sense into you.
This message brought to you by the...
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Why is Connor having trouble focusing in school?
Having trouble finding Connor, middle school? Would you like directions?
No, why is Connor having trouble focusing in school?
Finding lowest airfare to Istanbul.
No, I'm tired of fighting with him over homework.
Home, walk, restaurant. Need a review?
No, I need help. He's very smart, but his mind wanders. He's disorganized.
I think I understand.
Ah, oh, good.
Finding best potatoes for French fries.
No!
Russet, fingerling, Yukon gold.
Why don't you understand me?
Sorry, I was trying to show how Connor feels every day. Frustrating, isn't it? Redirecting to understood.org.
For the 1 in 5 kids with learning and attention issues, this is what life can feel like. Explore understood.org, a free online resource about learning and attention issues, designed to help your child thrive in school and in life. Understood.org, because understanding is everything.
Brought to you by understood.org and the Ad Council.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.
Welcome back, and thanks for joining us. This is Donnell Edwards Viewpoints, and our very special guest is author and foster care advocate, Ms. Shenandoah Shuffalo. And our topic for discussion this evening is the perils of our broken foster care system. Before asking my next question, could you explain the current process? What typically happens when a child enters into the foster care system?
Sure. So obviously something has happened at that child's biological home that the authorities have been called in one way or another. And so whatever that decision, once a child's been removed from their biological home, the process is that usually some sort of CPS, DHHS worker goes and speaks with the child, interviews the child is removed, and then it's time to find a placement for that child. And really, as sad as it sounds, and it's one of the things that bothers me about the system, is that essentially a social worker is calling available homes on their list. So people who are already licensed as foster parents and finding out who is willing to take that child. Oftentimes, a social worker has limited information. For example, I have a boy that's age 6. Are you willing to take a boy who's age 6 or a girl who's 12? And the foster parent has to typically give an immediate answer, yes or no. If they answer no, they move on to the next parent, so forth, until they get a yes, and then the child is placed there. So that's what happens immediately. There's obviously then court dates. And all sorts of things can happen at that point, but it's really just a matter of finding a place that has a bed to take a child.
Okay. Now, based on your own personal experience within the system and what you've learned and observed as a foster care advocate, how are the outcomes different, or are they different, for Black, Latino, and other minority children in the system from white children?
It's a great question. I think one of the major myths about foster care is are Black, Latino, and other minority children disproportionately in the system? And the truth is there's actually more white children in the foster care system than any other race. Now we can see where there's the trend in different specific neighborhoods where clearly more Black children are being removed. But overall, if we look at the situation nationwide, there's actually more white children in the foster care system. Now, with that said, I think what is maybe different for Black, Latino, and other minority children is that they're less likely to be placed in a family that looks like them or has a similar culture or religious background to them. And we see this quite often, that most of the foster families are also white. So you have this interesting thing where white children are often placed in white families, but Black, Latino, and other minorities are also often placed in white families. And I think that can cause some other issues as well. When you're already being removed from your biological family, you know, you have everything taken from you. And so when I'm speaking with people who have never experienced the foster care system themselves, I say, imagine when you're walking through the grocery store next, or you're on the way driving to work tomorrow morning, and you pass a stranger, whoever that stranger is. Imagine yourself as an adult person with all the things you have in your life, with all the money you have, all the social skills you have, your driver's license, your job. But every night you have to return and live with that stranger. How long until you feel comfortable? And I ask that of adults, and most adults who are honest will say, gosh, it would probably take me months before I started to feel comfortable. And I, you know, but that's what we're asking children to do. And then on top of the fact that they're children and they don't have your social skills and your driver's license and your job to sort of escape from every day, they also have a traumatic background and experience. And we've just uprooted them from everything. They don't remain connected to church, which we know, and their spirituality and their culture, which we know is one of the things that can help them build resilience and heal the trauma we talked about earlier in the show. So I think that's one of the things that I see that is probably affecting outcomes more differently in that population is the fact that they don't even have that sort of culture and religion to hold on to when entering the foster care system.
Okay. I guess one of the problems, and I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself with my next question that I'm going to ask you, but I just wanted to ask, is one of the serious problems across the board for all children, regardless of their background, finding people who will adopt them, and what can we do? What can we do to help correct that particular problem?
Yeah, the foster care and adoptive is a conundrum. I mean, in the country right now, we currently do not have enough foster families to service the amount of children that we have in the nation. So we have a foster parent shortage. And I think we have that shortage for lots of reasons. I think the system is very difficult to deal with, both as a foster parent, both as a kid, and as a caseworker or anyone else in the situation. It's a government entity. It's a big thing. There's lots of rules and things get misapplied all the time. And, you know, it's a almost immovable object, if it were. And I think that deters foster families from wanting to continue. I think we lose good foster families because of that. The other problem we have is that because we have a shortage, we tend to get looser and looser on the rules of who could become a foster parent because we're in such desperate need. And that, of course, causes a problem as well, because as soon as you start loosening those rules about who could become a foster parent, you get some unsavory characters, unfortunately, sometimes, who do things to also, abuse and take advantage of their position of power as well. So it's a very tender balance there with foster parents and what we need to do. But I do think it's one of the major issues, and it's one of the reasons I'm such a proponent of a place such as Krosnor, which is a boarding school for foster youth in North Carolina, because they're able to service more children. The people who are working with the children are professionals. They're trained. You know, I think it's a thing that we could be looking at with foster families and switching that to actually people who have a degree in doing that so that they could help children heal and that they would be better qualified to handle the kids that are placed with them.
Okay. Now, if we haven't already answered this, what I wanted to ask is, what is the major problem in your view with the foster care system that needs to change? And if we already addressed that in the comments you just gave, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the major problem is this. We have to put the kids at the center, and we have to stop saying that it's a one-size-fits-all solution. So in our country, we tend to sway back and forth between every kid who comes into care should be adopted to every kid who comes into care should be reunified with their bio parents. It's not an either-or scenario, unfortunately. For some kids, they need to be reunified. For other kids, they need to be adopted. And for still another set of kids, there needs to be other solutions. In my case, I was never going to return home to my biological parents. I was, frankly, never going to get adopted. And so then what do you do for the kids who fall into that category? And so we need to sort of widen our view about what we consider family, what we consider having stable, positive adults in children's lives, and how we're going to help kids who neither get adopted or reunified with their parents to move forward positively after they age out of the foster care system. So for me, the major problem is that we're not truly focused on the child at hand. We're focused on a lot of other people. We're focused on giving bio parents an opportunity to get themselves together. We're focused oftentimes on a court system and making sure that they have time and the judge's docket is running smoothly and all of those things. But very infrequently is the child the most important person in the room. And I think that's one of the huge things that needs to change in the system.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, is the problem a political problem, or is it a problem as a result of an industry that in some ways generates a lot of income for some people, or a combination of the two?
I think it's both. I think it's definitely a political issue. There are definitely senators today who are saying, you know, a foster kid needs to be in a two-parent home, and that's defined as a man and a woman, and this is what that looks like, and that's the only thing that will be acceptable, and they probably should be Christian to boot, you know, and that's what we think is acceptable for foster parents. There's definitely that political movement out there. And so it is a political issue, and it's also a systemic issue within this huge government bureaucracy and just the system that it is itself, right? So there are people taking advantage of it. There are people abusing their power. There are people who become foster parents because it's an easy way to pocket money and not take care of kids. And, you know, we've seen that time and again. We've seen people who have adopted kids and gotten adoption subsidies, but then the kids are out on their own taking care of themselves, and they're still receiving the subsidies and pocketing that money themselves. There's all kinds of those stories. So I think it's both. I think it's systemic within the system itself, and it is political. There are politicians who are trying to use this topic to sway voters as well.
Okay. Now, in your position as a foster care advocate and the work that you do there, as well as your speaking business, when you have an opportunity to talk to children or young adults who are still in the foster care system, what do you say to them?
Believe in yourself. It's the number one thing. If you don't believe in you, nobody else is going to. And it's the one skill I try to instill into young kids that I see all the time, and specifically those who are, you know, 15, 16, 17 and are going to be on their own soon. You have to do it for you. Nobody's going to do it for you. And you have to have the belief that you can do it. If you get tied down to, well, they said I'm going to turn out just like my mother, I mean, which was something I heard all the time until 18, is just give it time. She's going to turn into her mother. She'll have a teen pregnancy. She'll be a drug addict, all of those things. If you start to buy into that, you can get the victim's mentality, and you really have to believe in yourself and say, I want more for myself than this. And not that it's not a hard road. It is. But if you don't believe in yourself, none of the people around you will either.
Okay. Shenandoah, child welfare advocates say the system needs to change so that children spend less time in foster homes and with foster families and more competent. And young adults who have grown up in foster care also need more help in making the transition to independent living. Now, do you agree with those recommendations?
Of course. I mean, it'd be great if kids could spend less time in foster homes. The problem is that we don't get to dictate that. You know, that enters into what are the biological parents doing the things they need to do in a timely fashion. So we don't often get to dictate how long the child's going to spend in a foster home. The system surely does play a role in that somewhat, but a lot of these things are dependent on someone getting clean from an addiction, someone finding employment, and those things don't have hard and fast rules about how long they will take. Should foster families be more competent? Absolutely. I mean, I'm a proponent that being a foster parent should actually be a college degree that we give. I think foster families, I say this all the time, most foster families come into this work because they have the heart to do it. We absolutely need them to have the heart. But they don't have the skills to do it. They have no idea what they're going to be faced with that first placement. Most of them are caught completely off guard, and we could be doing an awful lot more to give them skills and help them to understand and give them supports to make that an easier transition. And then the stories about the youth who are transitioning out of foster care, I mean, there's horror stories all over about that transition. If you ask most adults, Were they ready to be independent at 18, both emotionally, physically, and financially? You're hard-pressed to find an adult who says, yes, at 18, I was ready to just be out on my own. And so we do need to be looking at ways to ease that transition and hopefully start making a dent in the fact that most of the kids who age out are going to wind up in prison.
Okay. Now, you went through the system and were able not only to overcome much of the adversity that you experienced, but to be one of the very small percentage who not only were able to go to college, but to graduate. Could you share with our audience and perhaps encourage any of those who may be listening how you were able to accomplish that? Because you mentioned that you had aged out of the system, and obviously that creates a problem because it's almost like you have nothing. I would imagine once you age out of the system,
you
have nowhere
nothing.
To go. Yeah. Okay.
That is correct.
So how were you able to overcome all of that and get into college and be a college graduate?
So for me, it's a very unique situation in that I was going to turn 18 halfway through my senior year of high school, really was just trying to get a high school diploma, and actually convinced my foster parents to allow me to stay if I would continue paying them the amount of money they had been receiving from the state of Michigan. So I was working a part-time job at a hardware store, and they agreed, which is how I sort of prevented myself from becoming homeless in high school, which most kids are not able to do. But that bought me time until May when I could graduate from high school. And in that transition, I was encouraged by a teacher to apply to college. I actually was told by the guidance counselor in my high school that people like me don't go to college. People like me learn to serve people like him. My teacher and I thought, okay, well, maybe I can do something. She helped me. She actually wrote a $125 check to go with my application fee to Michigan State, which happened to be her alma mater. She wrote the check for me because, frankly, I wouldn't have even been able to apply to college. And by the grace of God, I got in. And I was on campus for about 2 weeks when I realized I didn't have deodorant or toothpaste or feminine hygiene products and needed to get a job. And I ended up getting a job. And college really became a part-time thing for me. I became focused sort of on this job that I had, trying to make ends meet living in the dorm. I actually attempted suicide for the first time in my first semester of college. I mean, college wasn't the happily ever after. It eventually took me almost 6 years to get my four-year degree. You know, it was a lot of pain and struggle and just perseverance to try to push through because I knew it was the only way I could do something different with my life than anyone else in my family had done. But it came with a lot of pain, you know, of not being able to feed myself. And I talk in the book in great detail about being in my first apartment and having to put a $6 pan on layaway because I couldn't afford the $6 pan. And sort of going through that with no guidance from any adults in my life. So it was just me fending for myself day in and day out. And there's obviously some things we could do to ease that transition a bit.
Now, was it your counselor or your teacher that told you that people like you didn't go to college, but you were there to serve them?
Yeah, that was my school guidance counselor told me that people like me don't go to college. And my teacher, when I told her, she threw a tantrum and is the one who ultimately wrote the check to help me apply to college.
Well, I'm glad that your teacher was there for your support, and it's so sad and so unfortunate that we have people like that guidance counselor in our school system. Now,
how,
if you don't mind me asking, how were you able to cope with the attempted suicide situation? Well, I was told in a conference I went to that we don't say attempted suicide anymore. So
yeah. Well, I You know, I just thought it was so painful for me. I had survived so much up until 18. I thought right in my mind that just getting to college was going to be the answer. It, of course, wasn't, because there's a lot of work associated with that, a lot of things that I then needed. And I just was really depressed, really didn't see how the pain of my life was ever going to end. I tried taking a bunch of pills. It didn't work. I ended up waking up the next day. And I had a realization from a moment that I had with a sixth grade teacher much earlier in my life, a man that I only knew for a brief period of time. But he had told me, you're really special, Shen, and you're meant to do something in this world. And when I woke up from my attempted suicide, that really sort of came to the forefront for me. And I thought he would be really disappointed if he saw the mess that I had become. And that sort of was one of those things where sometimes you pay someone a compliment and you just don't know how powerful it can be, because that thing he had said to me, you know, when I was 12 years old in sixth grade, was now coming back to this 18-year-old girl in a dorm room who had, you know, just attempted suicide. And it was really a change for me to say, I'm choosing this now, nobody else. There's no court system, there's no judge, there's no social worker who's choosing this. I'm choosing, and I have to choose a new destiny.
Well, we're certainly glad that that worked out, because obviously you have major contributions to make to our society. Now, in conclusion, what can the average person do to help with this issue, with the problems
the
imposter care system?
So I have this saying where I say, adopt if you can, adopt, foster if you can't, foster, volunteer if you can't, volunteer, donate, and if you can't donate, then educate. You know, education is a big part of it. There's so many people who don't understand what's happening in the foster care system. There's so many people who just think, oh yeah, that's a system, it's working just fine. It's not. And hopefully if you listen to this broadcast today and you walked away with one teeny bit of information that you can share with someone over Thanksgiving dinner or a coworker at work, educating the people around you so that they understand what's happening is a huge part in helping us to fix this problem. So adopt, foster, volunteer, donate, or educate. Any of those ways you can get involved to help.
Well, Shenandoah, we thank you so much for being our guest tonight and for helping us to better understand the dynamics of the many problems that result from our broken foster care system and what needs to be done to fix it and how each of us can do our part to solve this critical problem. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, if you would like to learn more about our guest, her book is Garbage Bag Suitcase, and it's available at Amazon.com. And you can also get more information about the foster care system if you visit her website, which is also the name of her book, www.garbagebagsuitcase.com. Now, Shenandoah, if listeners want to find out how they can volunteer and where they can donate or get trained to educate, can they get that information at your website also?
They can absolutely. If they send me an email and tell me where in the world they are, I will even point them to some very specific places and they're near wherever they live to help them find places to volunteer or get more information locally for them.
Okay. And again, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming to share this valuable information with us this evening. Now, listeners, don't forget that we have a very special program coming up in our Race in America series when we return on December the 4th, featuring 18-year-old author and first-generation Pakistani-American immigrant Dua Hamad. We will be discussing life as a teenage immigrant in America and the challenges of living between two different cultures. That's on December 4th at 6:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. We will also discuss Ms. Hamad's book, Finding Home, which contains Ms. Hamad's compelling collection of poetry that paints a moving picture about immigrant life in the United States and her struggle to bridge two different cultures. join us for this very special program in our Race in America series when we next return on Monday, December 4th at 6:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Until then, have a good evening, have a wonderful holiday, and a great week.
This is the CWR Network, hashtag 1 million strong.